of State versus Oscar Ramirez. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Michelle Watson, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Ramirez.
Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Joshua Law, representing the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Good afternoon. John Mulcain, Assistant Hudson County Prosecutor on behalf of the state.
AG Sarah Brigham on behalf of the Attorney General of New Jersey.
Welcome, counsel. Please be seated. Please know that Justice Solomon will be participating. He's watching the argument, and he will participate with us in the deliberations. Ms. Watson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if necessary.
That's fine.
I had initially requested a preliminary statement, but I'd like to waive that today. New Jersey's liberal discovery laws promote the goal of providing fair and just criminal law trials. Our court rules reflect our open file approach to pretrial discovery and grants defendant automatic access to certain information, including the witness's name, addresses, and birth dates. This case is not about whether defendant gets access to the witness's address, the witness who is the victim in this case. Defendant is not entitled to the address under the protective order and will not have access to the address regardless of the outcome of this case because he's not challenging that component of the protective order. The narrow issue in this case is whether the state has established good cause to withhold the victim's address from defense counsel and the defense investigators. The bulk of the state's argument on good cause pertain to defendant himself and not defense counsel and the defense team. And this includes the victim's legitimate fear of defendant and the violent nature of the crime. Whatever safety concerns the victim has about the defendant, although he is in custody pending trial, those are concerns are addressed by not giving him the address. The state has also argued that the crime victim has a statutory and constitutional right to object to any disclosure of their contact information, but the rights of crime victims are not absolute. And this court's jurisprudence has affirmed time and time again that a crime victim's rights cannot automatically override a defendant's constitutional rights. The victim's contact information is critical to a defendant's right to confront witnesses, to effective assistance of counsel, and the right to present a defense generally. Defense counsel has an ethical obligation to conduct an appropriate investigation, which includes seeking to interview witnesses who may ultimately decline to be interviewed, but the right to seek an interview is a part of defense counsel's obligations. There is simply no basis, and the state has not articulated one, to believe that disclosure to defense counsel will compromise the victim's safety, will lead to harassment or intimidation. The good cause standard was not met in this case. The protective order was reasonable. It was a proper exercise of the trial judge's discretion, and it should be affirmed as it's consistent with our liberal discovery laws and it accommodates the victim's interests. Now, I'd like to turn to the good cause standard. So this is information that automatically has to be turned over, and the good cause standard is written very broadly in the rule. But again, this isn't about denying defendant access to the information. This is about denying defense counsel. Good cause has to have some concrete basis, and it can't be based on the victim's generalized fear of the defendant. If that were the standard, then good cause would always be met in a case where there are serious and violent allegations. There's no question that the victim is afraid of the person she believes victimized her, but there's no actual evidence that the defendant will seek to harass or intimidate her while the case is pending. Now, the AG has cited a number of cases that really drives home the point that good cause requires particularized facts, not simply the fact that this defendant is accused of a violent offense. Some of those cases, Williams, which is the California case, their defendant was a gang member and threatened the victim before the preliminary hearing. There you have more than just the instant offense, and you have an actual attempt to harass or intimidate. State versus Dean, the Ohio case, threats had been made against the victim after she testified against a co-defendant. Again, concrete evidence. People versus Ray, the Colorado case, That was a post-conviction case where the defendant was seeking addresses on PCR after the protected victim had already testified at trial and had been cross-examined, so that the use of the information was less important. The underlying allegations, which is what the state is saying here, that this was a violent crime, no one disputes that the allegations are serious and the offense was committed in a particular brutal manner. But unless there's a reasonable and particularized basis to believe that defendant's access to the address will compromise the victim's safety, the underlying allegations can't simply be the basis for good cause.
Was that all that was presented here in seeking a protective order, other than the facts that there was an alleged crime and the alleged victim does not want to be contacted? Is there anything else in this record to support good cause? That was argued by the state.
It's primarily the underlying allegations that they're really serious. The victim's fear of the defendant based on the underlying allegations and not any conduct subsequent to his arrest, and the desire to not be contacted by the defense.
How about the defendant's alleged assertion that he had killed people in Mexico?
I don't think we can give that statement much weight. I don't actually have the full context of that statement. I guess it came out during an interrogation or where he was being transported from one place to another. I don't know if there was something that was lost in translation. Defendant is a native Spanish speaker. The state hasn't corroborated that. I don't actually know if defendant has killed people in Mexico. But I think we have more compelling evidence about how defendant will conduct himself. This defendant does have two prior convictions. There are a third degree offense and a simple assault from, I think, a couple of years ago. There's no evidence that he harassed or intimidated the victims who were associated with those cases, so I think that's more compelling information about how he will conduct himself.
The allegation here is that he threatened her with a box cutter, a potentially fatal weapon, during a sexual assault. That's obviously a very violent crime if it occurred, and there was a threat to her in that context of severe violence. So we're not simply talking about the fact there was an offense here that is alleged. We're talking about a very threatening situation for a victim. And they were not acquainted, apparently. She was walking home from work. I mean, this is not a garden variety offense, I would respectfully suggest.
I'm not suggesting that it is. This was the allegations are serious and troubling. However, defendant is not going to have access to her address. So to the extent that that could provide good cause to deny him access, that's fine. We're not contesting that. But then it doesn't provide a basis. There's no link then to why defense counsel and the defense team can't have access to the information. And there's no risk. You know, I guess the state, it's unclear to me why the state thinks the defense team and the investigators can't have the information just based on the violent nature of the crime. There's no actual risk of inadvertent disclosure. The state hasn't provided any evidence that that will be the case. Defense counsel is an officer of the court. He has an ethical obligation to comply with court orders. There is, the defendant is confined. If this information is given to defense counsel in a sealed document, then there is no actual risk that it will be shared with the defendant.
In the facts of the case, as are presented as of this point, he also threatened to kill her directly if she didn't remain quiet. Is that correct?
During the commission of the crime.
True.
Yes.
Does that factor into the analysis at all in the way that you're arguing?
It doesn't factor into the analysis as to why defense counsel can't have the information. It may provide a basis for why defendant can't have it. But I think, you know, I understand that there was probable cause to indict the defendant, but he's still presumed innocent. And unless he has done something, we're presuming that he did, in fact, make this threat and that he's going to act good on it. But he hasn't been convicted yet. And maybe in another case, it's enough to say that a defendant who makes a very particular threat to a victim shouldn't have her address, and that's fine, but that doesn't extend to defense counsel and the defense investigators.
If the court were to enter an order directing
that the arrangement for a virtual conference, by Zoom or otherwise, would that be satisfactory?
Such as a Zoom conference or something like that. I think in the appropriate case, it may be okay to have some alternative way of the defense team having direct contact with the victim. But I do want to point out that that's probably going to really interfere with defendant's ability to actually get the victim to agree to an interview. As defense counsel argued below, and as the California appellate court said in Reed, it's really difficult. Victims are going to be reluctant to agree to an interview, and the defense team's success depends on making the victim comfortable, building some sort of rapport. And that's not going to be as effective during a Zoom conference. We've all lived the last 2 years on Zoom, and we understand that there is a difficulty in making a connection with the person in that forum. But I think
you don't contest she has an absolute right to refuse an interview.
I do not contest that. Defendant does not have a right to actually get her to agree to an interview, but he does have a right to have access to adverse witnesses pretrial.
Do you agree that the defense team cannot come back months later and ask a second time? But we have some additional or different information. We'd like you to reconsider what you told us earlier. Is that prohibited?
I think the general practice is perhaps to seek to interview a victim once, and if there's a change of circumstances that the defense team is aware of, then perhaps they may try to recontact the victim.
Why should that be permitted? Why shouldn't the victim have closure if they've already told the defense team directly, I do not want to be interviewed? Why should that be reopened for any reason?
Well, I suppose a trial court could, when the victim is objecting, could enter an order saying that you have the right to approach the victim once and ascertain her intent. But given her strong objection, we're not going to allow you to go back. But I do think that the normal practice is, under the correct circumstances, to reengage a victim who perhaps, or a witness who was perhaps initially reluctant. The passage of time may change someone's...
Witnesses and victims are on two different planes under our statutes. I mean, the victim has a right to refuse and to have that respected by the system in general, correct?
Yes.
So a witness who may have been present for a crime or for whatever reason doesn't have that same protection. We're talking about here a victim as to the legislature is afforded certain rights and spelled out quite expressly that one of those rights is to stay away from an interview.
The right that she has is to decline to participate in the investigation. Seeking disclosure for address is not directly implicating that right. She still ultimately retains the right to not agree to the interview. But the state has decided to indict the defendant, and that triggers the discovery rule, and there can't be a veil of secrecy surrounding the victim. And also that the scope of the right can't permit the victim to cooperate with the state to bring charges, but then to selectively decide which aspects of the prosecution she'll comply with. In effect, by agreeing to have charges brought against the defendant, she has agreed to participate in the investigation.
So you're saying she's waived her right to refuse this interview?
I'm not saying she's waived her right to refuse this interview. I'm saying that she's waived her right to opt out of the investigation altogether and to say that I don't want certain information disclosed about me.
Aren't there reasons for the defense wanting a victim's address other than a desire to talk to the victim? In other words, talk to neighbors and other people in the community to learn more about the victim?
And that's what we've argued as well, that this isn't about just her desire to not be interviewed. I think the ACLU has laid out in its brief that in doing any sort of background information of a person, it's important to have this additional data point to verify that you have the person, you know, this is in fact the correct person that you're looking for. But also, you're correct, he does have the right to investigate her reputation in the neighborhood. I'm not saying that defense counsel is going to do this or it may be wise in a certain case, but this is information that is admissible in court, and he gets to decide how to proceed with the investigation based on the state's allegation. I think the problem in this case is that we're looking at the facts and we're deciding that this is the scope of viable defenses, and so you don't need this information to pursue those defenses. But that's not the purpose of discovery. He's entitled to this information, and he gets to decide what investigations will support the defense.
If there's a clear-cut threat against a victim, a particularized serious threat against the victim, are there circumstances where it would be appropriate to withhold the address from the defense team, short of there being an allegation that's specific to the team?
I think we've seen in some of the cases where a person is in like protective custody or something like that, then that may be a basis to not disclose the information to the defense team, because that person's identity and whereabouts is supposed to be confidential from everyone. I'm having a difficult time envisioning a case where the defense team doesn't get the information unless the defense team has somehow conducted itself recklessly and perhaps has revealed information in other cases or something like that. But we have to presume that defense team can comply with this order, and the state isn't making any assertion or has not provided any facts to suggest that disclosure to defense team will result in disclosure to the victim. To the defendant.
So if there was to be a limited disclosure to defense counsel, would you agree that there should be appropriate limitations placed on that disclosure regarding, similar to the conversation you had with Judge Sabatino, regarding the number of times the victim can be contacted if they've declined an interview, regarding the manner in which investigators can approach the victim, and the fact that, you know, the investigator should make it clear to the victim who they represent and who they're working for? Do you think that there should be these appropriate limitations?
I don't think they're required in every case, but I guess in an appropriate case where the state is seeking additional restrictions and the victim is objecting, but that wasn't requested in this case, and that's not the state's position that there should be, that we need to be limited in time, manner, and place. Because we can presume.
Well,
we can presume that defense investigators are going to conduct themselves ethically. So we don't have to. I don't think the standard practice should be in every case there should be all of these limitations.
If she were to convey directly to the defense team, I do not want someone coming to my home representing the defendant, period. Does the defendant have the right to? Does the defense team have the right to send an investigator to her home?
If she were to convey this to,
she were to convey it by Zoom or by some method directly to defense counsel, I don't want anyone approaching my home. End of story. Does the defense team have the right to say, maybe she'll feel better in a week, we'll send somebody to her home?
I think if there's a forum where she's able to convey that to defense counsel or the defense team without the interference of the state, then that wouldn't be justified.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Please finish.
No, but I do want to emphasize how critical it is for the defense team to be able to have this conversation to ascertain the victim's willingness. I mean, you can imagine the conversation that is had with the prosecutor. It's not a conversation where the prosecutor is going to be encouraging her to agree to an interview or something like that. Defense counsel is not going to have a right to interview a victim under circumstances where there's this decision that's made at the outset, and there's never the opportunity to just have a conversation explaining what this entail and why the defense team wants to have this interview.
Yeah, so picking up about the reference to home, which I find a very difficult subject myself, we know that in other areas of constitutional law, some of which great public defenders advocate, home is a sanctuary in our law. There are certain activities about a home where people should feel secure and not have to endure interference, trespass, insecurity. So under the First Amendment, for example, certain free speech activities are limited often by a distance to someone's residence. In search and seizure law, defense lawyers appropriately argue very strongly against warrantless searches of homes. So that there's a recognition generally in our law that home is a special place. In light of all that, should there be either a presumption or a heavier burden by the defense to permit an interview at a home as opposed to some other location?
Defense counsel is not seeking access to her home or to get inside her home. Is simply seeking the opportunity to go there and have a conversation outside the home. I do want to point out
outside of the building, you mean?
Outside the building. He's
in
not
the yard,
asking.
And is that any less stressful or?
Well,
or
I mean,
when they knock on the door and the person then steps outside, isn't that equally potentially of the same level of invasion on their solitude?
I understand. The outside of the home is accessible to everyone, right? Like, police officers can go to people's homes and knock on the doors and ask if they're willing to be interviewed, or it's not, there isn't some special protection that prohibits anyone from going to someone's door. But defense counsel is not seeking to get inside her home to have this interview. He's seeking her address to do his relevant background information and to be able to engage with her about her willingness to be interviewed.
But the trial court's order is unrestricted in that regard, right? under the order, defense team could go to the home and, you know, directly confront the victim and ask to speak with her and so on. There's nothing in the order that's on review that limits that in any way, right?
To simply go to her home and see if she's...
Well, the
ready.
Simply is always a charge word for all of us, right? to
I'm
go
sorry.
To the home.
to go to her home. There's nothing in the order that prohibits that, but the state wasn't seeking some restriction on that. They were just saying you shouldn't have it altogether. So this wasn't an issue that was litigated below.
Right, but in balancing all these very important interests on both sides, would a trial judge abuse her discretion in saying, you can do these things, but you can't go to the victim's house? Why would that be an abuse of discretion?
If the defense counsel is prohibited altogether from going to the victim's
right.
house?
Yes.
Because the defendant has a right of access to the victim to see if she's willing to be interviewed. And I'm not sure where if there's an alternative forum where the state isn't present and this conversation can be had, then that may be appropriate. But I think that this is how these things generally play out. There's a right to have the contact information and a right to speak to the witnesses and the victims, unless there is good cause. And good cause is simply not a conversation that the state had previously where she said, I don't want to do this.
So would allowing defense counsel to have a conversation with the victim outside the state's presence, would that be sufficient? That would be a conversation where defense counsel, defense investigator, would have the ability to assess whether that victim wants to submit to an interview. Would that be sufficient?
I think that may be sufficient, yes.
Without having to provide an address and a surprise visit from an investigator at either 6 a.m. or 11 p.m. since there's no restrictions, that's, you know, I think that's what Judge Sabatino is getting to and we've been getting to, you know, the providing the address so that there can be an assessment of whether the victim wants to be interviewed. That means somebody can show up at any time of the at morning, noon, and night and confront this victim, which might not be, you know, something that the victim wants to happen near their home, which is their sanctuary. So if it's in balancing all these interests, would allowing defense counsel, defense investigator to get the victim's phone number and have a phone conversation outside the state's presence, would that be sufficient?
The address may be relevant for other purposes, but in terms of seeking an interview, I think there can be reasonable limits, but we don't have any reason to presume that the defense investigator is going to, it would be unreasonable to go to someone's home really early in the morning or really late at night. Like, they too have ethical obligations in terms of speaking with victims and witnesses. And I think as defense counsel made very clear here, and it makes sense, like, They don't have an interest in alienating a victim anymore. That's not going to play well with the jury. Like, there are a lot of incentives here beyond the ethical obligations for the investigators to conduct themselves appropriately. And we don't have any...
Assume absolute good faith and appropriate conduct on the part of both the defense investigator and the state's team that's working on the case. What if the victim says, I don't want to do it? I don't want to go to this third-party location. I don't want to participate in a Zoom conference. I just don't want to. What then? What authority is there for any action that you would propose?
Well, I think that would, that maybe suggests why. So if she just want to go to the third-party location, then the defense team have to be permitted to at least be able to visit her home once and see if she's willing to speak with them.
Are these orders unusual, or are they common or getting common, or what's your experience with these types of orders?
So I've never practiced as a trial attorney. From what I understand, since the decision in this case came out and is a published appellate division decision, trial attorneys are seeing more of these orders where the victim's contact information is automatically redacted and they have to go and litigate whether they can get access to it.
Anything else you'd like to present?
No, if the court has no further questions, I just ask that in keeping with our open file approach to discovery, defendant respectfully requests that the court reverses the appellate division's opinion and allow the protective order solely giving access to defense counsel and the investigators to stand.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court. I agree with what Ms. Watson said, but I actually take issue with one early thing, which is she said the question in this case is whether the state satisfied good cause under 313.3e. That's not the question in this case. The question in the case is whether the trial court abused its discretion in finding that this protective order was sufficient. There is a deferential standard of review that I don't think has been given enough cover here. I'd like to start, Judge Fischer, with the question you asked, which we, as Ms. Watson said, we referenced in our brief, which is access to the victim is only part of why home address is necessary. It's necessary as a corroborative tool, which is the reason why the rule has been expanded to allow date of birth. I mean, date of birth isn't inherently a source of impeachment. It is a source of corroboration of who the person is. I want to agree that the facts alleged in this case are awful. They are horrific. It is a serious case. It is as serious as they come. But we don't calibrate a defendant's right to wage a defense based on how bad the case looks on paper. And that, when you read the briefs, there's a lot about how strong the state's case is, but it hasn't been tested yet. And so until it is, of course it's going to be strong. In fact, the attorney general says one reason why the defense attorney need not meet with the victim is the defense attorney already has the victim's version of events from the police reports. But that is so counter to the way law is practiced. That's written by someone who's never tried a case where you have one version of events and then a statement to the grand jury and a statement to the police, and they're all contradictory.
But the facts are relevant to the level of threat that this individual, but a terrifying ordeal if she is telling the truth, on her way to her home with a sexual assault and a threat with a lethal, potentially lethal weapon, and how that factors into her decision, if she indeed has made a decision, not to speak with the defense team. So obviously, it's the state's burden to prove everything by beyond a reasonable doubt, no question. But the facts do bear upon this question, do they not?
I think they bear most directly on whether a protective order should be entered against the defendant. But I don't see why there's this asymmetry in the way this case has been handled, in that we need to trust the prosecutor. The prosecutor says the victim doesn't want to talk, we should trust that, and we should.
But there's all this assumption of bad faith on the part of the Office of the Public Defender. There are ethical obligations, and there's a long track record of professionalism that I feel like are getting pushed aside here. And so, Chief Justice Ravner, I believe it was your question, you asked Ms. Watson, could she envision a situation where, assuming good faith, the defense team would be barred from the address? And I think I've come up with one, which is, assume the defense team is going to do everything they can to keep this information from the defendant, as they're ethically obligated to. But there are circumstances that make it impossible for them to actually keep that information. So assume the defendant is a gang member, and the gang really controls the neighborhood where the victim lives. So even if they don't say, hey, defendant, we're going to 123 Main Street, if the gang sees that the defense investigator shows up at 123 Main Street, that would reveal the victim's address. But there's nothing like that in this case. There's no indication that that couldn't be safeguarded. Judge Sabatino, I want to, I guess, push on some of the time, manner, place stuff and the home is a sanctuary. The home is a sanctuary under the Fourth Amendment, and there's a long line of cases that, you know, I think are right. And Murray v. Lawson talks about some protections residences get, but that's about getting in. That's not about information. There is no doubt that the victim has a right to not answer her door if the defense investigators come ringing. There's no doubt that she can tell them to go kick rocks or do nothing. And Justice Patterson, this gets to a question you asked. I actually don't think that derives from the sexual assault victim's Bill of Rights. I think that is a right that every witness or victim has. They don't have to participate. And they can be cross-examined later on that. And I'm going to get back to that cross-examination point. The sexual assault victim's Bill of Rights, which talks about the ability to participate, if you read the whole law, it is a limitation on law enforcement. What it says is law enforcement cannot strong arm a defendant who doesn't want to report a sexual assault to the police or wants to stop after going to the police and doesn't want to proceed. But what can't be done is this selective idea of I'm willing to participate in the case all the way through to the end, but not do the things that are necessary to ensure the defendant gets a fair trial.
So is it your position that the words to choose whether to participate in any investigation of the assault means that if the victim speaks to the prosecution, she must speak to the defense?
No, of course not, because no one must speak to the defense. I'm suggesting I don't think it's a statutorily given right to not speak to the defense. It's an inherent right to not speak to the defense. But by the
same token, but in addition, we have crime victims and sexual assault crime victims singled out in a statute that specifically addresses the ability of the victim to say, I don't want to be involved with this.
But they can't choose which parts to be involved in. For example, they couldn't say, I'll participate directly.
Under the statute, it's all or nothing? Is that what you're saying? If they speak to the police, they must... The statute...
No, I don't think it's binary in that way, that you either participate or you don't. But at each step of the way, you can choose whether to participate. You can speak to the police, but not the prosecutors. The prosecutors, but decide not to go to trial. But once you decide that you're going to trial, you can't, for example, say, I'll be examined on direct examination, but not on cross-examination.
No, that's all due process. We're talking about interpretation. So do you view this statute to mean that if she speaks to the police... She doesn't pull the plug on the investigation on the charges. She's willing to go to trial and testify. She then has to participate fully in discovery.
Yes, but participation fully in discovery does not require her to speak to the defense team. But it does require that the information designated in 313.3 be turned over. And again, perhaps not to the defendant, and that's not at issue in this case.
I want to ask you, Mr. Shalom, about something in your brief.
Just the Chief Justice.
But if I follow up, same language in C7. Your thoughts about the scope of that language? It speaks about choosing to participate in an investigation. Here we're post-charge. It doesn't say investigation and prosecution. Is that a difference that matters?
I don't think so. As I suggested, I think when you read the entire Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights from beginning to end, it suggests that the victim retains the ability to pull the plug at any stage, before going to the police, after going to the police, before going to the prosecutor, after going to the prosecutor. I understand, and maybe this is what Judge Sabatino wants to ask about, in our brief we talk about the ability to compel a victim to testify. I think it's possible that you could read the Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights to preclude that sort of compulsion, but again, that's a fight down the road for the state to have with a victim. We don't take a position on it.
Actually, I was going to ask you about something else in your brief.
Please.
How essential is it for the defense to obtain the address from the prosecution where, as your brief acknowledges, there's all sorts of address information that's available through all sorts of data sources on the internet and otherwise. Your brief says, well, you know, some people just don't have a digital footprint. This particular victim, for example, moved after, you know, the event. But, you know, in a way, are we arguing about something that's really not all that essential to get from prosecutors because the defense has other means to track down the address of where the victim is living?
So that's not how I read that portion of the brief, Judge Sabatino. What I read us talking about is some people will have easily findable routes. I mean, if we just look at this court, if you'll forgive my informality, Justice Patterson's name probably is not going to give us that much information alone, because both her first and last name are relatively common. Justice Pierre Louis.
I planned it that way.
Your way to remain anonymous, I understand.
Yeah.
Whereas Justice Pierre Louis' name might give us more information. But we don't want to set up a rule that provides different access for John Smith than it does for
someone with a name like mine.
And so that it can be done. But the truth is, oftentimes with a name alone, you can't figure out, am I talking about the right person? And that's what both home address and date of birth provide, is that additional data point to let you figure out, is the person on Facebook the same person? Is the person in this credit report the same person? And so forth.
These additional arguments about the benefits of having the address, were they presented to the trial court or the appellate division? I thought the focus there was primarily on having the opportunity to seek an interview.
I think that's right, that's the argument that was raised by the defendant. But I think those interests are inherent in the rule. The reason the rule makes that discovery automatic is not just so an investigator can show up at your house, but also so we can learn this information that the U.S. Supreme Court has said is kind of a building block for presenting a full defense. But I'll concede that I don't think they were directly raised. I actually don't know what the appellate opinion, but I don't think they were directly raised to the trial court. Last point on the repeated or late night visits. Again, state never asked for any limitation on that. And I think there's this real asymmetry between how we're treating prosecutors who we assume good faith from and defense attorneys where all of a sudden we're assuming that they're going to show up to try and make people feel. Those limitations can all be placed later if there's an allegation of harassment, if there's an allegation that they're not acting in good faith to try and get information, but instead to bully a person. But let me give you an example. Imagine if a defendant provided for the state a notice of alibi. Here's my alibi witness, and their name. I'll give you their name, and I'll tell you that they have no criminal record, or they do have a criminal record, but I'm not going to give you their address because they've had some terrible interactions with the police before. First of all, I'm not sure that would ever be sufficient for a court to say, okay, you don't have to provide it. But imagine if they did give the address, and they said, but listen, police should only come one time. If they say they don't want to talk, don't come back. We've never hamstrung police in that way. And for whatever it's worth, despite the sanctity of the home, Judge Sabatino, I think most people also wouldn't want police or defense investigators showing up at their place of work, their place of education. There's lots of reasons why the home, in this context, ringing the doorbell and saying, would you like to talk, may actually be less invasive, less harmful to one's sense of sanctity and privacy than other places where someone might be confronted. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Mr. Long.
Good Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers would like to thank the court for allowing to participate on this issue. Obviously, we echo the sentiments of the public defender as well as the ACLU. We would like to emphasize again that it is of paramount importance to the criminal defense bar in this state that it the presumption that criminal defense lawyers are officers of the court and that they are sworn to uphold the court's orders as well as the law and constitution of the state and of the United States is of paramount importance, especially with this with issue to key discovery issues here. I'd also like to add that it would appear that the case State v. AB is, or State in the interest of AB rather, is very instructive on these issues. We believe that the appellate division decision, while it gave passing mention of that decision, did not fully discuss the issues in that case and the instruction that it gave, particularly when it went on to say that providing this information would violate the victim's privacy in accordance with
But in AB, this was the alleged crime scene.
Correct, correct.
And this so that, is not, and obviously the home in this case, especially, it's not even potentially near the crime scene. It's not, there's no crime scene information that can be gained from access to the home here.
Correct. My point about that would be, while it is true that it is not the alleged crime scene here, it does address similar circumstances. And the important thing in this aspect is that the court in AB said that criminal defense lawyers were fulfilling a rather ordinary undertaking in that in their representation of their attorney. I'm sorry, of their clients in doing so. That's the same thing here. It would be clear malpractice, and it would certainly provide an opportunity for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim if counsel were not to investigate all the leads and attempt to interview, especially the most key witness in a case such as this.
Right.
So
but
in
AB,
that respect,
but AB was a very central inquiry that was being made by the defense lawyers, and that is an examination of how the rooms were configured, sight lines, and so forth that were directly at issue on the question of guilt or innocence.
Correct. Correct.
It wasn't just simply a matter of accessing a witness at her home versus accessing a witness in some other way to determine whether she was willing to speak. AB went well beyond that in terms of what the court was addressing.
Right, certainly. But my point was simply that that it is important for when the court is looking to balance these interests between the defendant and the victim, it should be examining what it is that the defense counsel is seeking versus what it is that the victim's assertion of privacy is. Especially with respect to the fact that in AB, I don't believe that the court rule addressed there was any court rule on point that would require disclosure of that information. Here we certainly do have that. 313.3 does envision that we provide information about people who may be witnesses in the state's case. That's also an important factor to consider in weighing these here. We do certainly believe that the the constitutional and statutory rights of both defendants and victims should be read in harmony, as that case says. We just believe that when we have a clear court rule that explicitly outlines that this is information that must be disclosed to the defendant, that is a factor that we should be considering, weighing in favor of disclosure here, even when the victim does make, a non-regular assertion of privacy, as in this instance.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Law.
Thank you.
Mr. Mulkey.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. The appellate division correctly concluded that the trial judge abused his discretion in ordering the state to turn over the victim's address to the defense and not appropriately weighing the victim's constitutional and statutory rights bestowed upon her by this state. If there was ever a case for an unconditional protective order, this is the one. I do want to speak about the facts briefly because this is a very fact-specific argument. October 2019, a woman finishes up her shift at work. She wants to go home. She had a right to be left alone on her path home, but unbeknownst to her, the defendant secretly followed her. He sneaked up behind her in a blitz attack, held a box cutter, a fatal weapon, to her throat, and adding to the horror, he forced her into a cemetery, of all places. He covered her mouth. He told her multiple times he would kill her if she was not quiet. He raped her. He violated her sexually in different ways. He also stole her personal belongings, her phone, her purse. Then when he's caught, he tells a Hudson County Prosecutor's Office Special Victims Unit that he's killed people before. Not just one person, but people. And I note that the ordeal only ended because the defendant heard a siren and fled. The defendant's charged with kidnapping, a first-degree crime. This defendant's charged with 4 first-degree counts of aggravated sexual assault, other crimes as well. But thankfully, that siren sounded, and the defendant fled, and the victim became a survivor instead of potentially becoming a homicide victim. The state takes the defendant's words at face value that he's killed people in Mexico. If there's ever a declaration against interest, if you say that to a police officer, we have to take that at face value. The survivor, however, in this case, did not keep quiet. While in her underwear, she bravely held down a random car and went immediately to the police with the help of those Good Samaritans. She cooperated in a police and prosecutor's office investigation and will participate in a trial. If the defendant wants a trial, we'll give him a trial. And he'll have the right to confrontation at that point, but he ought not to be given essentially a right to a deposition of a victim in a criminal case, in a case in which she expressly states that she does not want to speak to the defense. As I read the defense arguments behind their request to receive the victim's address over her expressed wishes, I'm reminded that the same public defender's office convinced a trial court in another case of mine, State versus Gilchrist, to order our Hudson County Prosecutor's Office Special Victims Unit detectives to photograph a rape victim over her consent in a brutal residential home invasion aggravated sexual assault in which that defendant threatened her if she went to the police. And the appellate division in State versus Gilchrist correctly noted that the confrontation clause, it's not a constitutionally compelled right to discovery in a criminal case. The appellate division in that case correctly applied the victim's right, a rights amendment of the New Jersey Constitution mandating that a victim be treated with fairness, compassion, and respect. The court correctly applied the Crime Victim Bill of Rights, which requires dignity and compassion and the right to be free from intimidation. And I note that that is years before the Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights was enacted, which gave victims an enhanced right in sexual assault case. The facts in this stranger-on-stranger aggravated sexual assault case are horrific. They're extreme. Even by the standards of a prosecutor who's been assigned to the Special Victims Unit since 2003. The protective order subsection of the discovery rules, it's not new or novel, it exists for a reason. And the standard is only for good cause shown. A prosecutor does not have the luxury of only having to meet that standard very often. Due to the egregious facts, the state easily met that standard and then some. The state's position is that on any standard, whether it be by good cause, by probable cause, by preponderance of the evidence, by clear and convincing evidence, or proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the facts of this case are enough to justify an outright protective order without any compromise. The victim's not consenting to the defense knowing where she lives. As is her choice, she has expressly chosen not to speak to the defense team at this point. She wants to be left alone. The appellate division correctly considered the victim's rights under our state constitution as well as their statutory rights under the Crime Victim Bill of Rights and her enhanced protections the legislature added when it passed the Sexual Assault Bill of Rights. For purposes of this argument, I'm of course relying on the briefs my office filed as well as the one filed by the Attorney General's office and of course the well-reasoned unanimous decision of the appellate division written by Judge Fuentes.
You're done with your opening statement, counsel?
Yes, Justice.
The allegations, to be sure, are most serious. No one is disputing that. I have not heard that in the argument. You said that the defense has essentially come forward and asked for a right to a deposition in this case. Can you tell us when and where they did that?
Well,
I thought they were entitled to the address under the rules, and you came forward and said, don't give over the address. When did they ask for a right to a deposition?
The state's position is that in this case, in which the victim specifically stated, I don't want to speak to the defense, the public defender's office saying, well, we do not care. We want the right to be able to speak to her. And by giving the home address, they will inevitably go to the address and they will say, well, all right, I know you told the prosecutor that you don't want to speak to us, but here we are. We're at your home. We want to speak to you regardless.
And we want to speak to you. You're equating to conducting a deposition?
Well,
bit of an overstatement, no?
Justice, the point is that in New Jersey, of course, there's no right to speak to victims or witnesses before trial. And by ignoring the statement that the victim told the prosecutor's office quite clearly she does not want to speak to the defense, they're essentially saying, well, all right, judge, give us the right to speak to her anyway, and, you know, let's ask her, let's hear it from her.
So the way I hear it, it seems that they're seeking the opportunity to test the representation that's been made in good faith. She doesn't want to speak to you, and perhaps try to persuade a witness to do otherwise. What's wrong with that?
Well, the trial court judge in oral argument below actually pointed out to the public defender when he had said, you know, our investigators, they're good at convincing people to speak to us. The trial court judge said, well, doesn't that imply that there's some kind of cajoling if you're essentially saying, well, the default position is we understand that this person doesn't want to speak, but we're going to try anyway.
I'm assuming that your office has had many a situation where a witness initially has no interest in speaking with the prosecutor and with the prosecutor's investigators. And yet, after meeting and sitting and talking and reasonably persuading, that witness comes around. Fair?
Yes.
Why shouldn't that opportunity be afforded to the other side as well?
If it's a sexual assault case, we, as prosecutors, can't necessarily ignore a victim's wishes to not participate in an investigation. If there's an allegation of sexual assault, one of the first things in cases is, do you want to have a criminal investigation? If the victim says no, then there isn't any further going ahead. And of course, I know that there are going to be cases where there are witnesses in a homicide case that might be a little different, but the state's position is that a sexual assault case is very different, and the public policy of the state and the courts have also recognized that.
And you've presented a rather cursory certification. That's not a criticism. It's just a few sentences that says she doesn't want her address information provided to the defense. Would you accept that if it came from the from the defense team in connection with a witness under their control?
Respectfully, the state's position is that there is more in the certification because
there is, but with respect to the address.
It depends on the circumstances, but
you'd accept there are situations you'd accept that from the defense attorney. Thanks, counsel. I appreciate it. We'll move on.
Well, it depends on the circumstances. If we were told, you know, in the past that this person doesn't want to speak to us and we see that again, that's different. Of course, if there's a danger of a false recantation or some type of consideration that there's pressure put on the victim, then, of course, we would want to speak to that victim to verify. But that's very different from a prosecutor submitting a certification, which, of course, the rule does not require. The rule just requires a written statement. And it could also be a written statement under the procedure part of the rule that is inspected by the court alone. And certainly, we didn't go ex parte.
I'm not trying to be critical of the certification itself. I'm looking at the strength of what's been communicated. Can you respond to the question I posed to defense counsel? What about a virtual conference of sorts that the court might direct? What would your position on that be?
There are potentially many different alternatives that the public defender's office could have asked for instead of saying, we want the address. And similarly, there are many different alternatives that the trial court could have potentially suggested or ordered that would not have risen to the level of an abuse of discretion as in this case. And frankly, those are, one, if you don't want the certification, there could be an affidavit, have the actual victim sign the paper. Two, there could be a recording of the victim being specifically asked what her position is in an open-ended way, and that could be just audio or it could be video. There could be a phone call. There could be, as you suggested, a video call. The state would be opposed if there was a request to bring the victim in, but none of these less restrictive options were presented by the public defender's office. And frankly, the public defender's office wants the address. It just did not seem that that was ever an option. And frankly, if the public defender's office had said, how about we do a Zoom call, the state would not be in the position of having litigated the matter. We would have, perhaps been annoyed that the certification
in terms
was an honor.
Of where we are now with a protective order, with the court's order reversed by the appellate division, it's on appeal here. Why isn't that an equitable solution to the issue of access to her for purposes of determining her willingness to speak?
The facts being so egregious in this case, we do think that there is really no reason to compromise in this case.
I thought you just said you wouldn't have litigated it, but at this juncture of the case, you have a different posture?
Well, speaking out of principle, but my point is that the facts of this case are just so extreme that, if there's ever a case for a protective order that's not compromised, this is it. But certainly at the beginning of the case, we're reasonable. We try to work out things as we ought to with our colleagues across the aisle. And it's a discovery issue. So, of course, we try to work those out. But, the facts of this case are so extreme. And, of course, I'm speaking hypothetically. The first thing we would have done is say to the survivor of the crimes here, how do you feel about this? And then we would have weighed our options.
I want to go back to the motion papers. Shouldn't this motion have been dead on arrival without her certification that she does not want to cooperate?
The state's position is that this, I'm surprised that the trial court granted this. We have not seen that. We don't file many protective orders because the overwhelming majority of sexual assault cases, as we all know, the victim is known to the defendant. The defendant knows where the victim lives. And of course, the majority of sexual assault cases, we don't have these egregious facts of a threat of death. We have them sometimes, but of course, the defendant actually saying he's killed people, that's just not something that we see. So the state's, Justice had asked about the certification and the length of it. Playing Monday morning quarterback, had I known.
I'm talking about the signer of it. Shouldn't that be from the victim herself?
Well, again, the rule does not require it. The rule requires a written statement. It doesn't say it's a written statement to be signed by the victim herself. Of course, I'm not speaking to a victim under these circumstances without someone there with me to be a witness if there was a request for a hearing.
Yeah, but you're asking your friends over here to take your word for she does not want to cooperate. How do they know, because you're not trusting them, how do they know that you're not pulling a fast one on them?
The facts of the case,
shouldn't the trial court that's ruling on this motion have more information than what you provided?
Again, we would ask Your Honor to consider the very egregious facts of this case.
Allegations. Not facts, allegations.
Yes, except that the proofs are particularly strong when it comes to the DNA that was found There was a source identity statement that the defendant's DNA was found in a genital swab as well as the underwear of the victim, not to mention he is saying on tape to our detectives, I've killed people, and there's no pre-interview, there's no audio recording only of his confession. We start recording as soon as we start speaking to him. But the facts of this case, I mean, it's not a stretch in the state's position that given what is alleged to have happened to the victim, that the victim is saying, I don't want to speak to anyone on the team. I was told that if I didn't keep quiet, I'd be dead. Well, I'm going to talk. I'm going to testify. So the public defender's office is saying, well, come on. I mean, certainly, why don't we just ask her? Maybe she will want to speak to the person who's we're representing, who did this to her. But the facts of the case is just not a stretch that under these circumstances, the victim says no. And there are cases where we say, okay, do you want your address given or do you want to speak to a member of the investigating team if they contact you? Sometimes the victim says, yes, no problem. Sometimes the victim says, on the other end, no, absolutely not. Sometimes the victim says, well, it depends. Where are they going to be? Could you be here with me? Or could Detective so-and-so from SVU be here? There are many different responses that we get in cases, but this response just absolutely makes sense based on the egregious facts.
Mr. Mulkeen, would you agree that if the defense team obtained the victim's address by other means, either on the internet or by talking to people from her place of employment, whatever, that as long as they don't do it in a harassing way in violation of the statute, the defense team can go to the victim's home and try to convince her to be interviewed, that there's nothing that prevents that, right? If they obtain it in some other way other than from the prosecutor's office.
Yes.
So I'm thinking, what are we protecting here? Because if, in fact, that is permissible, then you might spare a lot of, you know, other Ann Pattersons or Jack Sabatinos getting, you know, bothered by defense investigators where, you know, inevitable discovery is a concept you know about. Inevitably, they might be able to get it anyway. So how strong is the interest here in privacy where so much out there is on the internet or otherwise through, you know, good investigative techniques obtainable?
The survivor in this case told us that she moved. So she made arrangements to try to change her location. And there is, of course, in 2022, a vast array of information that's available. And I would point out what the state did give to the defense. Of course, we gave the victim's name. We also gave the a rap sheet that included her date of birth.
Right. If they found her through those means, though, there's nothing that precludes them from going to her house, right?
Yes. And I joke about this. I might Google myself thinking, okay, well, I have my personal phone number that's anonymous. Maybe I come off the grid, but of course I see my home address with the Google Map directions to get there. But if a victim specifically tells us, look, I don't want them to have the address and then takes, changes her life, moves someplace else. And if she's able to keep her information offline, and I'm not sure that that's the case here, then we ought to respect that that life arrangement, that life rearrangement that she made.
Going back to the discussion of 10 minutes ago or 15 minutes ago, in terms of the question of her amenability to an interview, and there were a Zoom call in which you would not be on, the state would not be represented, between a member or members of the defense team, obviously the defendant not there, and the victim under circumstances to be determined in terms of a schedule that's essentially overseen by the court, the trial court. And she has the opportunity to say, I don't want to talk to you. And that ends the issue. Why is that not a balancing of the rights here that is consistent with the statute and with the court rule?
It certainly would not. It would certainly be preferable to just giving over the address, but we would certainly ask the victim, okay, you've told us you don't want to speak to the defense. The judge has ordered us to make sure that you do speak to the defense. Arguably, her express statement, "I don't want to speak to them," should be enough. But of course, we're going to be reasonable when it comes to working out discovery issues. But sometimes in a family court environment, perhaps one attorney sends a letter to the opposing counsel. My client does not want to speak to his ex anymore under any circumstances. Please make sure that your client does not contact the
client.
That's
not the same situation. That's not comparable to this. And there are really two levels to the conversation. The conversation is would you have an interview with us? And that if that were the question to be asked, and if she says, "Sure, I'm happy to talk to you," then they talk. If she says no, then she's respected. Why is that not an effective balancing of the competing interests here?
It could be a reasonable compromise, Justice.
So can you respond then to the arguments of the ACLU and the ACDL that doesn't address defendant's ability to investigate the case and cross-examine the witness effectively?
The idea that knocking on one's doors in 2022 or the neighbor's doors is necessary in an aggravated sexual assault case.
No, to have the address, to have that information in order to then conduct their own investigative measures.
One of the arguments was that there could be talk about financial records. Our position is that we gave the name, date of birth. You can enter that into database to get financial records. But of course, in a typical aggravated sexual assault case, we never hear that type of evidence. We just believe that it would be speculative to think that one can knock on neighbors' doors in 2022 and get information that would be relevant in a case like this. Of course, Rape Shield would prevent, there of course was a time when investigators did this, there was no internet, but Rape Shield, of course, would prohibit things like, if the investigator's going to say, "Well, have you seen this person? Does this person have boyfriends, or how many boyfriends?" Like the sort of things that Rape Shield would prohibit. I just, we're going to run a new rap sheet when it comes time for trial. We already ran one. If the victim has a conviction that would be subject to impeachment, that certainly would be relevant. That would come in. We could potentially ask the victim, "Have you ever made a false allegation of a sexual assault before?" That might be something that comes in a aggravated sexual assault case, and for good reason. But we really haven't had any specific investigatory potential outcomes identified in the defense arguments that would allow us to say this is just, more, this is not speculation, this is something specific other than I saw financial records. And I just can't imagine a sexual assault case in which a victim is asked about, whether or not she pays her credit card bills on time or is, or has any debt. And this isn't a case in the facts of this case where the victim has filed a lawsuit against the defendant to try to, collect civil damages. Maybe in that type of case, that could, but the state's position is that the arguments are speculative, and it sounds the reasoning in the Gilchrist court, the appellate division found that the public defender's office saying that the client is saying to them, "Hey, look, I might have had a relationship with this woman who's much older than I," in this allegation that the defendant broke into a woman's house, went through the window, raped her. Then you have a young defendant saying, "Well, I need a picture because maybe I had a relationship with her." But there was no further information that was given by the defense, and the appellate division said that this is the stuff of speculation, and of course correctly applied the Crime Victim Bill of Rights and the Victims' Rights Amendment to the state constitution.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
I would just like to close briefly that if the appellate division's opinion was reversed and we did have to give the address to the defense, I do believe that as a supervisor in the Special Victims Unit, we would have to raise this issue with victims very early on in the process and just say, "Just so you know, we're aware of everything that's happened. Your address might need to be disclosed to the defense if they want it." The state's position is that that would be it would have a tremendous chilling effect on...
Isn't that the state of the law now, given the discovery rule, that your address might be turned over?
Justice, I've never had a case. We don't file protective orders too often because we don't have these types of cases too often, but I've never seen a protective order application denied in any way until this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Brigham.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The Attorney General concurs with the state's arguments and emphasizes the following 3 points. First, the appellate division properly held that the trial judge abused his discretion in fashioning the protective order when he only took the victim's physical security into consideration and not the victim's constitutionally protected rights under our Constitution, the Crime Victims Bill of Rights, and the Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights, which the legislature, enacting and ratifying these laws, intended to protect the victim not only from physical harm, but from further emotional trauma as well. Second, the sexual assault victim here has expressed in no uncertain terms that she does not want to speak to the defense in person, by phone, or by video conference before trial. She is the victim of a violent sexual assault during which her assailant, which DNA evidence supports is defendant, threatened to kill her. And if defense counsel or a defense investigator shows up unannounced at her private doorstep, just so she can decline to speak to them in person, her emotional trauma from the sexual assault will certainly increase.
Do you have any evidence of that? Is there an affidavit to support that allegation?
So I heard your question for the state about whether or not a victim certification would be required. The Attorney General's position is no, because under subsection E2 of the protective order section, it states that a showing of good cause can be made by a written statement in whole or in part that could just be reviewed by the judge as well. So the prosecutor's certification is actually something better than that. It goes beyond a written statement. It's something he's swearing to that's true under penalty of perjury and should have been sufficient to show good cause. However, if the court is concerned about that and would require a victim certification, the Attorney General would ask for a remand for the state to make a showing for that new requirement. Because it would be new, because of the very important reasons needed here to protect the victim's address. That being stated, I'm going to go into my third point that I wanted to emphasize here. By maintaining the confidentiality of the victim's address, even from defendant's counsel and investigators, any right to access witnesses pre-trial will remain unviolated, as no violation of this right occurs when a witness voluntarily chooses, as here, to not be interviewed. The right protected is the opportunity for pretrial access, not a guarantee.
As we've discussed, what is the problem with having the victim tell defense counsel directly outside the state's presence that they don't want to be interviewed?
Two responses to that. First, it's because she has a right under the Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights, which I'm going to reiterate throughout these proceedings, it's the SAVBR, to not participate in any investigation pretrial, which includes the defense's investigation. And by her have already stating that, it's unnecessary for her to then have a video conference with defense counsel present to restate what she has already stated. It's just unnecessary. And the second reason is the showing of good cause can be made by a written statement. It doesn't have to, the victim doesn't have to be physically present before defense counsel to express her wish that she doesn't want to be interviewed. As for defense-
Would it be within the discretion of a trial court to order that?
The trial court could order that It's just unnecessary to do so here.
You're saying it's not in the rule, but it would be within the discretion that the trial court has to say they can have a conversation to determine whether or not she's willing to have a substantive interview, and that can be out of the by video, out of the presence of defense counsel.
Yes, the trial judge could have ordered that. It's just unnecessary to do so here because she's already stated that she doesn't want to be interviewed. As for defendant's confrontation right, that also remain protected because it's a trial right that is exercised through cross-examination at trial. It does not mandate pretrial disclosure of all information that might speculatively be useful in contradicting unfavorable testimony, especially where the victim has expressed she does not want to be interviewed pretrial. This case thus only involves honorably preserving the constitutionally protected rights of a sexual assault victim and the remaining semblance of security she has left in her private home. The appellate division properly took the victim's rights into consideration and in harmonizing them with defendant's implicated rights reached the correct result to maintain the confidentiality of the victim's address to safeguard her from her from a further emotional trauma, which the Attorney General would ask the court to affirm his sound decision here.
Thank you, Ms. Wiggins. Ms. Watson, rebuttal? Please.
Your Honors, I'd just like to point out that the Fifth Gilchrist case is totally irrelevant. That's a case where the defendant was seeking information that is above and beyond what he's entitled to under the discovery rules. That was extraordinary discovery. So that under those circumstances, defendant had an obligation to make a showing of specific need. There is no obligation under the discovery rules for this defendant to explain why he needs the address. And I think the state's contention, which is really troubling, that when the state's proofs are really strong, then the kind of investigation that you would engage in is not as important. That's not the purpose of the discovery rule. Defendant gets to decide what's the appropriate investigation, and that decision is made through the lens of an advocate's eye, not the state. And again, I just want to point out that the I think Scholes is an interesting and helpful case in terms of thinking about like that there's no burden shifting framework for the relevance. Once information is automatically relevant under the discovery rules, defendant doesn't have to explain why he needs it. The Scholes was a case where there was about access to pornographic images. That was the images the defendant was charged with possessing. And this court established a framework, and the court said that fundamentally the threshold, defense counsel doesn't have to explain why he needed that information in his office as opposed to at a state facility. The court said, the defense is entitled to discovery. It's not incumbent on the defense to explain why it will be inconvenienced in its preparation for trial by the state's offer to allow evidence to be viewed in a state facility. Imposing that burden on the defendant subverts the open file approach to discovery in criminal trials.
But there is more at work here. You would concede that. You're talking about the victim's trauma potentially being exacerbated, not an issue in Scholes.
I understand that. I am sensitive to the victim's trauma, but this court also said in AB that this adversarial process, it is almost impossible to eliminate any anxiety that the victim will experience. It's not possible for us to do that while respecting defendant's constitutional rights. And I think in this case where the defendant does not get access to it, the defendant who is the person that she's afraid of, and the defense counsel has an ethical obligation to keep this information confidential, but also in the way that he conducts himself as it relates to the victim, then those concerns are adequately addressed.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.